Welcome to Hold My Reg, a Quill and Sword podcast brought to you by the Administrative and Civil Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. Administrative law may not always make the headlines, but it is the invisible force that maintains discipline, ensures fairness, and ultimately keeps our military running smoothly. Get ready for another insightful discussion, and we hope you enjoy this episode.
Hello, and welcome to the BDE Best Department Ever's podcast series. Today, we're talking about an area that no commander, no spouse, certainly no judge advocate ever hopes to deal with, which is survivor benefits, but which we all need to be prepared for. What benefits families or members are entitled to, what support judge advocates and commanders provide after what is likely the most traumatic event in a surviving family's life, the death of their service member spouse. We hope that this will provide you an easily digestible resource to turn to when it happens. I'm Major Kira Riggs, current professor of administrative and civil law at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School, where I teach graduate course students, senior officers, and general officers about survivor benefits in the context of how it can help them take care of our military families. And today I am joined by Ms. Tracy Volke, Gold Star wife and surviving spouse of her high school sweetheart, the late Major Paul C. Volke. Ms. Volke, would you mind sharing a little bit about your background, what led to your advocacy and substantial contributions to developing laws to support and provide for our Gold Star families?
Absolutely. Good morning, Major Riggs. This is a very important topic, and I'm honored to be here today to share my background, my experience, and some developments on this topic. As in my background, my husband, Major Paul Volke, was killed in Mazar-i-Sharif, Afghanistan in 2012, while on his fifth deployment serving as the executive officer for 140 Infantry, which was supporting the Combined Joint Special Operations Task Force. I had been a military spouse at that point for about 12 years and an attorney. I was also the family care team coordinator for our unit, so I should have been prepared for the myriad of benefit complexities that would ensue after my husband's death. And I'm sorry to say I wasn't very well prepared. Following his death, I returned to work and decided to refocus my career in an effort to serve our military community. And my first job was with the 3rd ID Fort Stewart Legal Assistance Office. And then I moved into my current position at the Office of the Statute Advocate at Fort Belvoir. I currently serve as the legal counsel for service members, their families, veterans, retirees, and Gold Star families. Outside of my military work, it's also important for me to help surviving families with legal matters, including benefit selections. I'm also a member of I'm a board member of the 98 Fund Alaska Project. I'm the survivor outreach coordinator there, which is a West Point-based nonprofit that helps veterans and surviving families. And just recently, we built a camp retreat in Alaska for surviving families and veterans to honor the fallen service members and provide hope and healing for veterans and surviving families. Since 2018, I've also advised the Chief of Staff of the Army, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and the Director of the Army Staff on issues affecting military survivors as part of the Survivor Advisory Working Group. In addition, I recently served on the DoD Working Group, Making Your Final Wishes Known, and I'm currently serving on another DoD Working Group regarding survivor benefits.
Suffice to say, this is both an area that seems important to you and that you clearly have a lot of experience in. I'm really grateful for you taking the time to join us today. Would you agree that this isn't an area that a lot of judge advocates deal with, even though maybe we should?
I would say that. It's really easy to kind of pass this job off to the commander and the casualty assistance officer. But I think what's best for Gold Star families is for the judge advocates to have knowledge of these benefits. Army Regulations 638-8 creates an obligation on our brigade commanders to monitor and coordinate all aspects of deceased casualty case management, including ensuring the accuracy and completeness of casualty reports. Often these are the line of duty investigations, and these investigations are going to deliberate what benefits are available to family members and how they must use those benefits. Army Regulation 638-8 holds battalion commanders responsible for contacting the families, sending a letter of sympathy, especially being the face of the Army. But why wouldn't a judge advocate be involved in that? Why wouldn't A judge advocate makes sure that the commander is prepared to talk to the family. The commander is in the best position to both support the family and, depending on the cause of death, even defuse a potential lawsuit. This isn't a place for the casualty assistance officer to act alone and unafraid. Our judge advocates need to be involved. On the survivor end, legal assistance attorneys should work with the families to ensure that there are not matters for probate, that the survivors have a solid estate plan themselves, including powers of attorney, and also ensure that taxes are properly filed. My understanding is you touched on those issues in another podcast.
We did touch on taxes briefly with regard to spouses and MISRA. But the point is, there's a ton of benefits that are available to society, to survivors. Easily more than a dozen, some of which interact or cancel or reduce benefits based on taking some sort of combination of benefits. And while you mentioned the Casualty Assistance Office as a valuable asset, there still remains a significant role for judge advocates to play in educating families, ensuring they're provided for, and helping them focus on the future when the future might not be what's in their near view. But since I want this to kind of be a user-friendly episode, we're just going to discuss a few significant benefits that judge advocates might not have heard of, myself included, really, until I got into the schoolhouse. But there is a standard training package available on tjaglicks.army.mil that lists all of the benefits to surviving family members and a discussion of how they apply, when to apply them. But the big one, if people stop listening in the next 5 minutes, that I really want to dig into is the HEART Act, the Heroes Earning Assistance and Relief Tax Act of 2008.
Thank you for highlighting this benefit, Major Riggs. The HEART Act is an important benefit available to surviving families that is easily overlooked. While there are a few benefits for the HEART Act for surviving spouses, the big one is the Roth and Coverdale contribution exception.
So in 2023, just to get everybody on the same page, total contributions to all traditional and Roth IRAs and civilian accounts cannot exceed between $6,500 and $7,500 for those 50 and older.
That's right. But the HEART Act permits surviving spouses who receive the death gratuity, which is currently set at $100,000, and SGI benefits, which is currently set at $500,000, to invest some or all of those funds into a Roth IRA or a Coverdale education account. Just a clarification here, SGI just recently this year increased to $500,000, and we're waiting on the Department of Defense to confirm that the maximum contribution can be $600,000. Putting it another way, the limit for most people is around $7,000 for our annual Roth contribution, but a surviving spouse can potentially put $600,000 into a Roth contribution, basically tax-free on the way in and tax-free on the way out. This is also assuming that their spouse elected full coverage for SGLI and death gratuity.
And on top of being able to set aside at least $500,000, maybe up to $600,000 tax-free, these funds can be withdrawn, as you mentioned, or even passed tax-free, whereas withdrawals from a traditional Roth are typically penalized. Withdrawals from that SGLI death gratuity contributions can be withdrawn tax-free. This is a huge benefit at any time, up to the amount of the initial investment. And the same goes, as I understand it, for the Coverdell account, the only limitation being that the withdrawn funds must be used for the beneficiary's qualified education expenses to avoid any other penalties and taxes. So by example, if we have a Sergeant First Class Smith who dies on active duty with full death gratuity and SGLI coverage, he leaves a spouse with two children behind, a large mortgage, several credit card bills. Mrs. Smith could invest, we'll say $500,000 into a Roth and try to continue to pay the bills if she chooses. If she can't cover the expenses at some point or just wants to pay off the house, she can withdraw any amount up to that $500,000 to take care of that. So let's say she withdraws $250,000 to pay off the house. She still has $250,000 left. And if her children later go to college, she can then withdraw, say, $100,000 for each of them to pay for college expenses. Depending on how much time has passed, even the state of the markets, even though she spent $450,000, she probably still has over $50,000 remaining as it has grown tax-free, all of which she can withdraw as needed.
That's correct. And from working with survivors, I think they're a bit nervous about putting all those funds into a retirement or educational account because they think, well, I put it in there and now I can't use it and I can't withdraw it without getting penalized. However, everything that you put into a Roth IRA can always be pulled out without penalty. The principal can always be pulled out. You would only need to let the IRS know via your tax return that you took out a contribution. A word of caution, you know, we're talking principal here. You cannot pull out any of the interest that money has earned without penalty. The catch is that it must be done within 1 year of the service member's death. And I can't emphasize this enough. This is where commanders and judge advocates can come in making sound financial decisions in the face of devastation, which can be extremely difficult. I know several survivors who missed that deadline and are basically losing out on a huge amount of retirement that they could have earned had they known about the benefit. And there is some discussion amongst the policy folks to see if a law might be appropriate to extend that deadline. I just wanted to add that in.
And that's really the reason I wanted to talk about the HEART Act first, because it is so significant, but it also is a decision that has to be made timely when it might not be super easy to make those decisions. So while we have a couple more important benefits that I want to talk about, if someone tunes out after knowing about the HEART Act, I feel like we got that important information out. But for those sticking around, since we are talking about education, how about we talk about the educational benefits that are provided by the Department of Veterans Affairs, especially Survivor Independence Educational Assistance versus the Marine Gunnery Sergeant John David Fry, or Fry Scholarship for short, and the post 9/11 GI Bill.
Sounds great. So these education benefits are available to children and surviving spouses of service members who died in the line of duty or suffered a service-connected death, but they cannot receive both that DEA and the Fry Scholarship. They have to choose one of them. They can receive post 9/11 GI Bill benefits in addition to Fry or DEA if the service member transferred these benefits, at least 1 month of these benefits, prior to death.
So why would a spouse or child choose DEA or Fry over the other?
Well, DEA is going to cover a longer time period. It's going to cover up to 45 months of school, but it pays a fixed rate of up to $1,265 per month. In contrast, the Fry Scholarship is going to provide just 36 months of benefits, but it's going to cover 100% of those benefits, meaning the cost of in-state tuition at a public institution in the state that you're going to college in, plus BAH and a book allowance for the year. So it certainly pays out more benefits. So it just depends on the type of educational program that the surviving spouse or child intends to pursue. If you're talking about some sort of trade school, typically DEA might be a better fit. These tend to be lower cost institutions with less traditional schedules where you might need the 45 months of education benefits. If you're talking about the traditional brick and mortar institution, generally speaking, the Fry Scholarship is going to be much more advantageous because it closely mirrors the GI Bill. Essentially, it is the GI Bill. It's an extra 36 months of GI Bill for survivors. The big takeaway, though, and where Gold Star family members lose benefits is when they only know about one of these and that the other fund might have been better or more appropriate. Once they elect the one fund, they cannot use the other. It's irrevocable.
And that responsibility to educate on the benefits falls within the Veterans Affairs Department. But casualty assistance officers, aided by their judge advocates, it's helpful for them to have a clear understanding of these benefits just to educate, help our surviving family members, and make sure the commander's tracking what they should be talking to those family members about.
Absolutely. There's another benefit that I want to talk about, and it's one of those benefits that can be a little tricky. So dependent indemnity compensation, it's also called DIC for short. It's a benefit paid by the Department of Veterans Affairs. It's a monthly tax-free benefit paid for a service-connected death. For 2023, the rate was $1,562.74 a month. A spouse also gets an extra allowance for each child under the age of 18. Once the child turns 18, that extra allowance is eliminated. And if the surviving spouse remarries, DIC ends unless he or she is age 55 or older at the date of remarriage. However, if that subsequent remarriage ends due to death or divorce, the spouse can retain the benefit. And if the spouse remarries, the child can receive that DIC until age 18 or 23 if enrolled in college full time. The amount per child for 2023 per extra child is $330.49 per month. Note also that if a child has disabilities, permanent disabilities, they may qualify for lifetime DIC.
And DIC is also related to the education benefits, DEA and FRI scholarship that we just talked about, right?
Exactly. It's important for judge advocates and surviving families to understand the impact of selecting DIC, just like selecting DEA or FRI. A surviving spouse can receive both DEA and DIC, even though they can't receive both DEA and FRI. In contrast, a child cannot receive DEA and DIC, but a child can receive both the FRI scholarship and DIC. So in most cases, the family will elect FRI for the child so that the child can also collect DIC. But this is not the blanket, the child shouldn't take DEA because they'll lose DIC. It's a consideration about what the child hopes to achieve and how much money is needed to achieve that. So in most cases, a child will elect FRI so they can also collect DIC.
So we've been throwing a lot of acronyms, a lot of numbers around. Generally speaking, what's the bluff of what DIC is?
DIC is an indemnity payment, right? So you're holding government harmless for the death of your spouse. And it is a great addition. And, if the spouse isn't remarried, the spouse is going to want to collect the DIC. It's a much higher amount than the child. But if the spouse does remarry, they can transfer that DIC benefit to the child during that age. So it's a lifetime benefit and it's tax-free. So it's really an important benefit.
So as long as the service member died in the line of duty or after retirement, the service member's spouse, children, parent, dependents can all collect DIC.
That's right. And I wanted to just bring one other thing to your attention. So after a service member retires, they're going to receive a disability payment probably from the VA. And then if they subsequently die after retirement and after their disability payment, at that point, the surviving spouse would also apply for DIC if the death was deemed service-connected by the VA and they'd get that benefit for life. They lose their disability benefits because that's the service member's benefit.
But you did say there, though, that they have to apply for DIC.
Yes, so you have to submit an application. That's right.
Okay. And recipients will only get any back pay if they apply within 1 year of the benefit step?
Yes. It's important to apply within 1 year. It can be longer, but be careful. There's a little trick to that where there's something called the Barring Act, which is you can't sue the government after 6 years from the date that you were entitled to the benefit. So there is a sort of 6-year statute of limitations on that that can only be overcome by filing an ABCMR appeal.
Are there any other cash benefits paid by the DOD that are important to discuss? Maybe the survivor benefit plan?
Yes. So the next kind of shift that we want to talk about, the two big financial benefits are the DIC, as we said, paid by the VA, but the survivor benefit plan is paid by the Department of Defense. And the survivor benefit plan is an annuity on a service member's pension that pays up to 55% of the pension that a service member would have received at retirement. There is no cost when you're on active duty. So if you were an active duty death, and your line of duty investigation is that the service member was in line of duty, you're going to receive SBP. When you retire, you actually elect SBP if you want it. You have 1 year to make that decision from retirement, and it will cost 6.5% of your gross retired pay for full coverage. If you die before your spouse, in that case, then your spouse gets the annuity payment. Again, I wanted to make another plug, a very important part of the survivor benefit plan. If you have a severely disabled child, that survivor benefit plan can be paid to a child for life, regardless of age.
That is a hugely important benefit. Just the options, knowing the options is hugely important. But we've talked a little bit about remarriage with respect to the other benefits. What happens, if anything, to SBP if the spouse remarries?
If a spouse remarries before age 5, the benefit is surrendered, just like DIC. Both these benefits end upon remarriage. However, unlike DAC, if there are minor children, children who are under age 18 or under 23, if enrolled in college full time, the benefit can continue to be paid to a child. So you can transfer that benefit to the child. But even if the spouse remarries before 55 and the marriage then ends in death or divorce, the spouse can reapply for that benefit. As we speak, there is currently proposed legislation to eliminate this remarriage penalty to both the DIC and the SBP.
That is fantastic information, especially in the most recent updates. I did hear, just speaking about laws, I heard something about a law that was passed in 2021, sometimes referred to as SBP or DIC offset or the widow's tax. Can you explain what that law corrected?
Yes, absolutely. That law, some advocates worked on passing that for over 2 years. So it was an extremely important law that was passed. The SBP DIC offset was an important piece of legislation that was added to kind of end this tricky benefit selection. So before the law passing, the survivor benefit plan was offset dollar for dollar by that DIC payment. In other words, a surviving spouse who received, just by example, $10 in SBP benefit would then have their DIC benefit reduced by $10. To avoid this offset, many surviving spouses, if they had minor children, would then transfer their benefits to their children for the SBP. So their children were actually getting the survivor benefit plan. This avoided that offset. However, when the child aged out of SBP at 18 or 23, the SBP ended and their spouse was left without any pension from their service member. Avoiding the offset in the short term placed many surviving families in financial jeopardy in the long term.
That seems extremely inequitable. How did the law change that then?
That law eliminated the offset. So now spouses can retain both SBP and DIC without an offset. Prior to the law, spouses had to make that transfer decision quickly after death. Until they made that decision, they wouldn't get their benefits paid. In addition to all the other decisions we've talked about today, it was a very tough decision. Furthermore, making that election between whether the child would receive FTP or the spouse, it was a complicated process. And once the decision was made, it was irrevocable. I have filed many appeals to the ABCMR to try to correct decisions where survivors were ill-informed, and I'm glad that they no longer have to make this decision.
What about state benefits? When we're talking about decisions they have to make, how do state benefits impact survivors?
In addition to all the federal legislation and benefits we've talked about, states also offer tax benefits and considerations to surviving spouses, but they vary among states. Last year, I was part of an effort in the Commonwealth of Virginia to equalize property tax benefits for widows where spouses died in the line of duty, but this would end up only applying to the state of Virginia. Many times, states use different definitions for benefits than what the DOD would use, and surviving spouses won't know to ask their casualty assistance officers about these benefits. Some states do not tax or all or part of military retiree benefits, and states may or may not include the survivor benefit in that tax exemption. For this reason, judge advocates should encourage survivors to check with their states, in addition to the other benefits we talked about, to see what is available to them and what needs to be considered when making their elections.
The ways we can support our military families after their loss of their service members, basically the summary of this podcast, is that it's not just limited to SGLI and death gratuity. There's just so much more. Federal benefits, state considerations, the HEART Act, educational scholarships, other compensation pots that they are maybe entitled to, but either just don't know about or just need support to see the financial way ahead after one of the most devastating losses of their life. So thank you so much, Ms. Volke, for taking the time to share your expertise, learned both personally and professionally on this extremely important topic. Until next time, thank you everyone for joining us.
This episode of Hold My Reg is brought to you by the Administrative and Civil Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. The views presented in this episode are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent the views of the Department of Defense or its components, the Department of the Army, or the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Stay tuned for another episode of Hold My Reg.